Political research specialist Mae Brussel, whose conspiracy newsletter appears in the Realist magazine, has for over 2.5 years shared with KLRB listeners the fruits of her decades' research into political assassinations and other abuses of power in America. Her weekly commentary on KLRB-FM is the most hard-hitting and comprehensive report of its kind in the country, relating as it does the news of the week to the evidence emerging about the conspiracy, which allegedly maintains its power by force over America's electoral and executive processes. Dialogue Conspiracy, a unique talk show. It's the most up-to-date, well-documented, no-nonsense political analysis going. And it goes over KLRB FM 102 on Monday afternoons at 5:15.
Well, good afternoon. This is Dialogue Conspiracy. It's Monday, October the 29th, the 124th week of our program, once a week, on KLRB in Carmel. The events of the past week that we talked about on Dialogue Conspiracy had to do with the firing of Special Prosecutor Archibald Cox, the Attorney General Elliot Richardson, and the resignation of the Assistant Attorney General Ruckelshaus in Washington, D.C. The marshals came in and closed up the offices of the investigation, and the evidence was locked up that the special investigators were working on. Dialogue Conspiracy, on that program last week, I was talking about what I considered were the main motives for closing up the offices of Special Prosecutor Archibald Cox that didn't have as much to do with the tapes in the White House as they did with his getting very close to the Howard Hughes, B.V. Rebozo, Richard Nixon connections. I've maintained for many, many years that the president is owned, and he's owned by a handful of people, and the major piece of the action belongs to Howard Hughes. Richard Nixon has represented the interests of the aerospace and the armament and the banking industries, but particularly Howard Hughes. Thursday, after our broadcast, the United States was put on a military alert for the first time since the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis. General Haig had ordered Mr. Ruckelshaus to fire Archibald Cox on the command. Your commander-in-chief has given you an order, which the gentleman had the good judgment to refuse. He defined the difference between obedience and patriotism and refused to obey the orders of the commander-in-chief. By Sunday, just yesterday, Karl Rahn was talking about the possibility of state of martial law. The Führer has spoken were the lines, and other writers were doing that during the week. Jack Anderson was writing during the week that the problem in Archibald Cox's office was that B.B. Rebozo seemed to be the bag man between Howard Hughes and Richard Nixon. And the Soviet Union came out and made the statement that the USA alert was, in quotes, absurd. They said the alert was to intimidate the Soviet Union and didn't serve to promote international relations. The important thing to remember about this controversy going back in Washington, in terms of my research or the way I approach things, isn't so much who handles the money that gets delivered to Richard Nixon or who buys his home. Does he pay taxes or doesn't he pay taxes? These things are important. But I had always defined B.B. Rebozo as the CIA babysitter for Richard Nixon. The important thing is that he gets his instructions down in the Bahamas, where the headquarters of the Nazis from World War II were brought over, the German cartels, and the communications and aerospace giants. And that B.B. Rebozo is the man that goes out alone with Richard Nixon on his weekends. The minute Richard Nixon leaves the White House, B.B. Rebozo is with him. We have mentioned him on and off our shows for the last 2.5 years, and I've used the word espionage babysitter. The man who tucks Richard Nixon to bed at night is hired by B.B. Rebozo, his valet, who is the last person to see him, who leaves his clothing or shoes at the door or whatever. He is assigned. I am sure the importance of this chain of command has more to do even with the kind of dwelling that King Richard lives in. When things get hot, such as the Alger Hiss investigation, when Richard Nixon was just a young man in the Congress and he was about to break down and had some misgivings or weaknesses, he was airlifted down to Key Biscayne and down to the islands in Coy Bay, and he is refreshed and given the support he needs to go ahead with the decisions he's going to do. The chain of command of orders to the President of the United States is what they were getting into. This would not be investigated by the Watergate Committee, the Senate Select Committee. They're not that sophisticated or knowledgeable to even want to know what the kind of relationship is between all these operatives. So they're looking for some illegal little thing like a tax matter, like that sent, similar to what sent Al Capone to jail. They're looking for some small clue to get rid of the operatives or to slap them on the wrist, but they don't really want to break down the chain of command. Congress doesn't run this country and hasn't for a long time. If it exerts itself now, it'll be a miracle, but it still has a long way to go to get to the crux of how decisions are made in Washington. The president, when he fired Archibald Cox, made a remark which I think is pertinent and should be remembered. He said, "I do not anticipate that we will come to a time when the prosecutor would consider it necessary to take the president to court. The prosecutor will not be permitted to receive what he termed presidential documents." So the controversy this week is raging on whether or not a prosecutor will be assigned by the president or a special court or by the Congress. But the president has spoken, and he has made it clear he doesn't think there'll be a time when the prosecutor, meaning any prosecutor, will consider it necessary to take the president to court. He's challenging Congress there for an impeachment proceedings. Now, there's been a lot of attention. We're going into the month of November this week, and there's been a lot of attention regarding the 10th anniversary of the assassination of President John Kennedy. I'm getting calls from different radio stations for interviews and different places to speak and different comments to write up for several articles, and it's in the air. People are reaching me, contacting me. Our local KIDD wants to do an hour show. Monterey Peninsula College wanted me out there. I'm supposed to be in Washington at the National Archives for a demonstration of researchers who will assemble, and there's a three-day meeting at Georgetown University where the researchers are going into the evidence of conspiracy that killed Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, and President John Kennedy all at the same time. It's a three-day conference, and I'll be doing some radio shows to Utah, Ohio, New York, and San Francisco. So there is a lot of interest generated 10 years after the death of John Kennedy. This interest that's generated is interesting for me. It's exciting. The more students I reach, the more young people, the more old people. It's great. I think it's very encouraging that 10 years have passed so quickly, but people haven't forgotten a moment. Those that were around remember the day, and those that were too young are asking questions. And the moment that John Kennedy was killed in Dallas, Texas, has not been forgotten. There's a lot going on KLRB every week. As I say, we talk about the killing of President John Kennedy, the evidence of his death, and other conspiracies every single week. This is what Dialogue Conspiracy is about here. So this month isn't a special month for me in any way because I work as hard every day, every week for the past 10 years. There was an article in the San Francisco Chronicle this Sunday which interested me in pertaining to this material because the article referred to California as the most educated state in terms, I guess, of statistics, in terms of population, the most college degrees, the most psychiatrists per individuals living in this state, that this had the highest degree of education, universities, university enrollment, otherwise. And the thing that came to my mind was the day that I became very anti-intellectual when I was attending Stanford University and was a philosophy major, and Adolf Hitler ruled Germany when we were in World War II. And I realized that intellects per se, psychiatrists per se, professors, have no meaning in our society unless they're doing something about the conditions that cause oppression, injustices, starvations, famines, cruelty, false imprisonments, that they are a perpetuation of the status quo. You can figure it out after Germany that had its culture with its opera, symphony, psychology, philosophy, and they became total barbarians, the worst the world had known since the history of man. And I became very anti-intellectual at that point when Adolf Hitler came to power in a country like Germany the way he did. So it's no glowing recommendation for California that they have all of these educated and professional people in the state. And I thought it flashed through my mind of the book that came out recently last year called California, the First Parafascist State. And I thought of the things that are coming down in California particularly because that's the area that I cross-file and study and pertains to political assassinations. And I thought about our prison system that's the third largest in the world. The most diabolical and the third largest prison population in the entire world is in California. I thought of our police department that's computerized and synchronized up and down the coast into Washington, and the head men are out trying to get hippies, radicals, minorities, Chicanos, harassing people, picking them up on the slightest little thing so they can get all this information into data banks and collect them all someday and bragging about their Gestapo. And I think about my evidence and research in the last years on the Minutemen and the independent paramilitary that have the full protection of the local police departments that link right up to Sacramento and to the White House directly and are utilized for areas like the fire at Big Sur that can be burned down by the Minutemen, hidden by the local police, used as a test for the Office of Emergency Service, blame it on the hippies. This is the utilization from the White House two-way intercommunication system they want to develop right down to the Minutemen, and this can be documented, the San Diego Minutemen meeting with Dwight Chapin, Donald Segretti of the White House, planning violence for the San Diego Convention. They're linked up and down the state. And they think of the CIA Army Proving Grounds all over the state, up near Sacramento, training grounds for the overthrow of the country. I think of the Attorney General, Evel Younger, I mention all the time, the defendant in a suit for covering up the political assassination of Robert Kennedy. And I think the plans to eliminate minorities, the testing of dune buggies that are going to go into hippie communes and desert projects in Africa, South America that are being developed in this state, and the armed forces, the special forces that are working with the police departments also. And these can all be documented. And here the average person is sitting here completely unaware of these forces, taking hold of their lives, worrying about earning a living or getting educated and whether we should have Proposition 1 or not have Proposition 1. And so for every week we go over the evidence that indicates where these pockets of oppression exist and who's behind them. And yet the state of California is as quiet for all of its intellect and education as Germany was at the time that Hitler came to power. There are three voices that are speaking up in California, and I'm going to talk about one of them today in particular, and I'll get to the second if I have time. One of them that I've referred to over and again many times is Lewis Tackwood, the Los Angeles Police Department agent provocateur. He has the new book, The Glass House Tapes, out. You can get your bookstores. Our local bookstore carries it, and Santa Cruz. And if you don't have a bookstore that has it, ask them for it, Avon Publishers. Lewis Tackwood, The Glass House Tape. He tries to expose in there the connections of the police department to the statewide level, to the national level, for the Gestapo takeover of the United States and the methods that they use. The man that I want to talk about today, another voice in the wilderness, his name is Daniel Del Solar. Daniel Del Solar, he's a journalist. He's from Venezuela. His mother's from Venezuela. His father's from Chile. He was a graduate from Harvard University with honors. He won a Fulbright Fellowship to a university in Venezuela. He worked in a institute in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and wrote an article for the Los Angeles Star, and it's been published elsewhere. He's asked people to write to Congress and please act upon the information that he's putting out now for you to hear. He works up at KPFA in Berkeley and San Francisco and is a filmmaker. And he has an article that just came out that he feels he was responsible for the murder of Allende in Chile. Del Solar feels that the work that he did in Cambridge was responsible for helping overthrow the elected democracy in Chile. Now, he had what he called a simulation game plan that he thought of in 1965. The Pentagon got from Del Solar it was an association they worked for, APT Associates, ABT, in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And they created a game plan called Politica. And they tested it, they created it there, and they tested it. And he helped them with a game plan. And in 1965, the game plan that he designed, Politico, was bought up by the Pentagon. Evidently, the Defense Department, the CIA, the national security agencies used this scenario. They used the scenario of the game plan that he had helped design. Now, he's feeling badly about this now, but I don't know what he thought they were going to do with it if they weren't going to use it. And this is the way the game plan worked, and I'll show you how it applied and how it worked in Chile and Latin America. And then next week, I'm going to show you how the game plan that was designed also for the third world countries has been applying to the United States of America for 10 years. My 10 years research, it seems, was the game plan called Camelot that was put on the boards from 1965 back at Cambridge, Massachusetts, the same area that's using a game plan for the Middle East, that used it for Chile, that have used it for 10 years in the United States, undoing all the plans that President Kennedy had in mind, or the Great Society, the change in societies that were to take place after World War II. Each one of these, by bills in Congress and moving the military force and by political assassinations, had to turn the clock back on history to take us back to, if not the Middle Ages, at least to where Adolf Hitler was in the 30s. Now, Politica was done in the office of Aft Associates, as I said, in Cambridge, Massachusetts. It's a small research firm, a think tank, and they had a small grant from the Defense Department Advanced Research Project Agency. Defense Department Advanced Research Projects Agency. On several other programs, I've talked about the Defense Department funding at Stanford University just the last couple of years on how to induce paranoia. Well, this is a different kind of a research that our Defense Department was doing. And the work was called Camelot. Now, that's very significant for what they were doing in the United States. But this was the plan. It was a multi-million dollar study on how to predict the occurrence of revolution in Latin America and third world nations. Now, that doesn't exclude the United States, but we'll talk about Chile today. Funded by the Pentagon, it was meant to be scholarly. There were questions raised about Camelot work in Chile, and a lot of the anthropologists wanted the project to stop, but the project went on. They thought maybe it was wrong. The New York Times revealed that there was this project, Camelot, and they thought it was improper. The State Department complained about the whole thing, and it, supposedly Camelot was stopped. But the Politica, the game plan went on, and it's hard to believe that the Camelot plans were ever stopped. They seem to be going full speed if you read news every day. Now, there was no money supposedly for Camelot, but there was money for the other Politica game plan, and they created a game with players and rules. And they mimicked a situation where the natives, so to speak, get restless, and the people take on different roles of the players in a country, how they would respond under certain situations. And the aim was to use this game plan to create the histories of every player in the game, and then look it over and pick out the most desirable players who you want to win. They had 35 groups of players and individuals that were responsible for political change in Latin America. Now you see how we can interpose that into the USA, 35 groups and individuals responsible for most of the change. And there was the government, there was the military, and there were the rich. Those were the three main bodies, and in those categories there were personalities in those groups. And they were broken into different regions. There are the main cities, the capital cities, the large city, the provincial city, the outlying areas, the agricultural, and the industrial regions. They broke into four parts. The players were considered middle class, or landowners in the capital, or students, or embassy, or foreign capitalists, or foreign managers in industrial regions. That would be like your ITT, the copper mines in Chile. You have your middle class, your landowner, your student, your foreign capitalist, and your foreign manager in industrial regions, the embassy of the foreign capitalist. Now remember, the natives aren't considered much on this. Those are the ones you do in. The students are in an intellectual level equal with maybe the middle class or the landowner, but the man who works in the copper mines and who needs the housing, the clothing, the education, the food, he's not considered in the game plan. The whole game plan is how do you control the country without consulting the natives. That's what it actually boils down to. Well, there were enough players, DeSalar wrote, so this could be a very realistic copy of a real situation to apply to any single nation they wanted to. And they made it very real. The description of the individuals were detailed, or the groups they were to represent. And they would vote for particular political parties, and they had choices. Now, this is very complicated, but you don't overthrow a country or create a conspiracy, the kinds I talk about, by just walking in and saying, this is it. We have martial law. I'm the Fuhrer. I'm the boss. You take over very slowly and systematically. So they would take these different players, and they'd break them down, how they break into coalitions, how they form groups. And we'll do this in comparison again in the United States, how the Chicano or the blacks would meet, how they communicate with each other from region to region, how they engage in business transactions, how they attempt to revolt, how do they go on strike, how do they engage in terrorism, how can they lie, bribe, or deceive? In other words, who's trustworthy? Now, these are the individuals that are broken into those groups. Then the government has its own problems that it's going to have to meet. How you open and close universities. Remember after Cambodia invasion and Kent State killings, the universities closed early, all the universities, nothing happened. It's a test case to close the universities. The government took positions on, one, how to open and close universities, two, how to order military actions, three, how to negotiate with other players or govern them by force. Do you govern them by force and act in a certain way, or do you refrain from acting and negotiate? You have those choices, either to order it, that they have to behave in a certain way, or you make a deal, or you refrain from giving orders. They work with the players, again, on how they relate, whether they'll strike, revolt, engage in terrorism, go into coalitions, try to communicate, work through business. Then you have the government's decisions on military action, and then you have the military. You have your game people, you have your government decision, and then you have your military. Now, the military could revolt against the government on its own and just turn it over. It can enter into coalition with the other groups and pressure the government. It can refuse to obey the government orders, or it can act on its own initiative and suppress the strikes or the terrorist activities. Those are the vigilantes. They can do things on their own. You see the vigilantes working in Chile now, where they want to eliminate the amount of political prisoners, so maybe there's been 2,000 deaths of firing squads and political prisoners, but the men they had in prison, they're letting a lot of them out, and then they're getting killed on the streets. So they say, well, we didn't systematically do that. The vigilantes are doing it. Well, the military has these choices it can do. The 1965, it was designed, it was submitted to the Advanced Research Project Agency, for short, ARPA, and given to the Pentagon. And the simulation then began. And Daniel DeSalar, who made up the games, found after Allende was killed and Chile was overthrown that this game plan that he designed was absolutely used in Chile, that the Pentagon did in fact take the game plan, Pacifica, and apply it to the overthrow of Chile. There were at least 35 players there, five or more referees, and they used to play these games. They'd take a day or two and make half-hour moves, and each player would take his position, and they would play these games out in different roles under different conditions. And Salar said if a strong enough group got together, it could take over the government. But the military strategy was, if the military leader wants to take over, he has to convince the other military leaders of all the other regions to join him. And he would work out to his geographical areas. And if he plays his card right, he'll get the support from the rich or the foreign embassies. Politica was played in Cambridge by graduate students from the Fletcher School of Diplomacy and Law. It was observed by the Pentagon representatives. And after their testing, Pentagon took the simulation game plans to its training planning center, and the Defense Department used them, and they were put into action in Chile. DeSalar feels very badly about this, and he talked about in 1966 they could chart out these game plans quicker by computers and use the computers to figure out how individuals or the military or the government would respond. So a model was played out by computers, and they had alternative scenarios. and it was quicker than human beings. He said it could be worked out in less time than humans. And they created a preliminary list of social variables and personality characteristics. Now, I'm going slowly over this because a lot of people wonder when I speak about the conspiratorial theory of history, how is it possible that so many people get together and put their heads together and can plan the overthrow of a country? It's very easy. It's like saying, how can one person go to a symphony hall and rent it and just strike up the baton and have an orchestra that night? You don't. In order to get a good symphony going, each one has his own instrument tuned up. His violin is tuned up. The piano player's fingers are exercised. The instruments are all tuned up. And when they go in and make the melody, there is indeed a score and a director. And when you get a symphony, it all comes out right, or should, after enough practicing and timing. When you read the history of America overthrowing 90 military dictatorships or putting them into power, and all of Latin America is military dictatorship except three countries, thanks to our efforts, we have perfected this thing so easily that just before the 72 elections in this country, we could overthrow the Philippines and put in a military dictatorship. The most difficult to do in terms of our Western culture was the one in Greece. I always said since 67 that was a test case for the United States, and this is the game plan that I'm talking about that was planned for Chile and other third world countries. And the name Camelot, as they will do next week, is the undoing of the last 10 years since the inauguration of since the assassination, actually, of John Kennedy. But the game plan began as soon as he became president of the United States, the arrangements to have him killed. Well, back to the computer game plan to show you the depth that these people go into things, the Defense Department and the Pentagon. They broke down all these different personality traits, how cohesive our organizations and people, how the economic groups, what is their interest pattern, the political groups, what are their economic goals. Are these individuals or groups influenced by other people's values, such as nationalism? Is that a selling point? What are their social weaknesses? What is their perception of need for standing alone? Or do they have to go in a coalition? How strong are they as individuals, or do they make coalitions? What is the group style or the way of doing things in regard to violence? Can you use persuasion? Can you appeal to honor or patriotism or unity or individualism? See, these are very important because Jack Ruby was given a pitch by a man connected to the CIA that it was patriotism to go in and shoot Lee Harvey Oswald. So in one swoop of the appeal of patriotism, the man could be involved in wiping out the political patsies so we wouldn't know what happened in Dallas, Texas. So they go into these psychological factors like the prone towards violence, striking back in a violent way, or persuasion, honor, patriotism, unity, individualism. The purpose was to provide training to military men and how political changes occur. This was the plans of Politica. Political changes just don't happen because the army comes in and says, I'm taking over. The police force can't just take over your community. You have to create the natural climate where there's so much violence and terror that when the policeman comes in, he looks good to you. Not that he's taking your rights away, but that he's protecting you. So the purpose was to provide training to military men on how political change occurred. Or they could also make the change occur in the Latin American countries, or like they've done in the United States. They played to determine if Chile would be stable after the military takeover, if Allende were still alive. Could they survive if Allende were alive, or if he were killed, would they be better off? Now, this happened when Diem in Vietnam. The plan was to overthrow the government and have a military takeover there, and they had promised, part of the conditions was that Diem would be flown away. His family was already out of the country, but then the decisions also were made that he'd be killed, and he was killed in a van. He wasn't allowed to be alive, and I'm sure, see, this is part of the game plan. Is it good to have a leader alive? Not very often. So the plan in Chile, and this was upset Mr. Del Solar when he realized that he had designed these game plans, that he had indeed been responsible for the death of Allende, because they had the provisions. Would the country be stable if Allende were alive? And it was determined by the analysis based on Politica that Allende should not be allowed to live. The game plan was played out by the planners and their counterparts in the Chilean army, and therefore Allende had to die. Now, Daniel Del Solar got out his old papers that he had done on the Politica. He wrote to the Washington Post. He wrote to the New York Times. He detailed his work. He told how it was used. He recognized it when Chile was overthrown and it was too late to do anything about it, and he was feeling very badly about what happened in Chile. He mentions the death of Allende. He says, he feels partly responsible. He says, I didn't do it, but I was made an intellectual as an intellectual. I was made a part of it. He was absolutely responsible for it. He felt it being the intellectual who helped design it. In Computer and Automation, Mr. Edmund Barclay, who publishes that magazine every month since May 1970, he's carried in every issue an article about the political assassinations, and he started with a first article, a page called The House is on Fire. And he compared the use of computer science to doing valuable work in our society and building a better bridge towards truth and justice as against the computer people in Nazi Germany, the equivalent, the mathematicians, the intellectuals that sat down and designed gas chambers according to how much fat a body had or weight or how much gas per weight per victim. And he felt that the intellectual minds were used for such evil forces, it shouldn't happen in this country. And that's why Computer Automation has carried articles on the political assassinations continuously. Well, Del Solar says that he felt that he was a part of the Allende death. Now, ITT was in Chile. Harold Janine, the head of ITT, had offered the CIA $1 million to remove Allende in 1969. The Advanced Research Project Agency that paid for pure research led to the creation of Politica, and the killing of Allende had the CIA all over it and the ITT too. And he was given what we call a quick burial with confusing reports, which were identical to Che Guevara's death in Bolivia just a few years earlier. The suicide of Brazil's president, Mr. Del Solar brought up Jânio Quadros in 1964, set up the military dictatorship there. I started my research into dictatorships and coup d'etats in 1963, but I was not aware of the death of the president of Brazil or how that military dictatorship came into power until I read the article by Daniel Del Solar. He cites the influence of copper on the decision to take over the copper mines and why it was necessary to get rid of Allende and get the mines back in the hands of the corporations that had it before. The U.S. copper users were desperate for copper. He says our strategic stockpile was already depleted and getting low had been committed. There were papers and reports on a copper shortage in the eastern states, and the Congressional Review had an article on the shortage of copper. Now, all of these comparisons are similar to the game plan of the Middle East to come in and take over the oil with the Arab nations and move our military into the Middle East at this time. This is a long-planned game plan, which I'll refer to briefly, but the preparation for that game plan, again, was a quick oil shortage, a gasoline shortage, a suggestion of gas rationing, just like the Congressional Review bringing in the shortage of copper, the papers talking about a shortage of copper. The justification for taking over the copper mines is set by Wall Street Journal and these people giving out interviews and articles preceding the overthrow of Allende in Chile. The same thing was happening in the Middle East just before the Army went in and the Marines go in and the servicemen from America are sent over disguised, and there's a lot of action. The Friends of the Middle East have been funding the Arab guerrilla group for the last 10 years. They can't just go in and start a war in the Middle East and expect people to buy that war. It's a contingency plan based partly on the diversion of the Watergate escalating in the Middle East now, but it would have happened as soon as the election was over anyway. But the way you do it is to quickly tighten up gas stations that closed on Saturday night, then they're to close on Sunday, a gasoline shortage, and then people begin to say, well, we have to have the war in the Middle East. You wouldn't want to be without gasoline. And there's a threat of rationing down to 10 gallons a week starting in the fall of this next year. And so naturally, the Middle East thing becomes a question of, are we going to be able to use our cars and get the gasoline and sacrifice a few Jews and let the Arabs have what they want, which is the land back again? These situations are built up in the media, in the market, by the people who already know what the weapons are there for and how the war is going to be manipulated when they're ready to go in. Henry Kissinger, in Le Monde, there was an article that came over our news service this last few weeks on Henry Kissinger meeting with top American officials as early as 1970 and planning this game plan of overthrowing Allende in November of 1970. It's alleged that this plan was all ready to go into operation. As far as the Middle East goes, there was news also of the CIA training camp that was in, it was planned in Cambridge, the same Cambridge, I don't know if it's the same apt organization. The research group, an independent study organization based in Cambridge, reports that the Marine War Games were conducted on a Marine base in the Mojave Desert and included active and reserve Marine units that were to go into the Middle East. Time magazine reported it August 27th. But the Marines getting ready, the amphibious Marines, to land over in the Middle East. But the important thing is, again, it's the Cambridge game plans getting ready for their African invasion and Middle East takeover. The planning of conspiracies is heavy nationally, statewide, and, of course, in even our local communities. Another man who I will be quoting a lot of times on my radio shows, who lives in San Francisco, who is of the same ilk as James McCord. He worked with the Central Intelligence Agency. He still has contacts and information. He is very anxious for facts that he has to be given over the media to warn people about what is happening in this country. And I feel that because I am a media person on the radio, that I have the obligation to pass on the things that he's saying. He read my two articles in The Realist. He contacted Paul Krasner, and he and other men who were in the agency, like James McCord, who's afraid of a fascist takeover, are now making movies to expose. The first movie they're doing is on the Middle East. The second is going to be on the dune buggies, and he wants to expose what is happening now to, in the hopes of preventing a full military takeover in this country. He's the man who backed up what I had already, the conclusions I had of the Big Sur fire. He's gone into depth for me on tapes of the Roseville bombing of the CIA, the military, that happened up near Oakland to test the Office of Emergency Service last year and test how a typical America town that isn't too heavily occupied will relate to this kind of off the service or the emergencies that would take place on our streets in America and the cities. Now, what this particular man said, I'll read you a page or two from a tape that I typed up. He said, what we have here is an American republic believing to such an extent that they are brainwashed, and they believe this is a just and wonderful world. There's a turbulence and a conspiracy, but nevertheless, they want to believe in their Constitution and their mother and apple pie. It is difficult to alert this country and throughout the media that the conspiracy is not something small. It is huge, and it is beyond the realm of most people's imagination. The conspiracy is for the world domination of the United States. This means total control of the economy and, for practical purposes, the complete solidity of Germany over Central, South America, and Africa, with Southeast Asia and the Middle East and Europe and Russia. And he refers to it as a great game. They use the media, the way people are controlled and manipulated. They know how to sweat and work their asses off, he says, the idiots that they are. They're all kooks. The people listen to the media and have not yet begun to take a form of action against some of the things that they're hearing. Anytime there is a conspiracy, he said, it is necessary to find out the extent of the conspiracy. Take the reality of the assassination of President Kennedy. Now, I'm quoting what he has said in a tape cassette that he sent down to me. I've never met this man. But Dialogue Conspiracy, as I said before, we talk about the killing of Kennedy, and we talk about all the little conspiracies that link to the big one. And we'll go into detail next week on Camelot and the political plans that apply to the domestic conspiracy. But this is what he's saying. Take the reality of the assassination of Kennedy. Why did they assassinate Kennedy? Why did they assassinate his brother? Why did they assassinate King? When you find the answers to these questions, you'll find more questions. And by the time you get them answered, the plot is so heavy that most people will say, wow, or gee, or gosh, and they don't know how to respond. Well, this is the feeling that I get from my research now, is that it's taken 10 years to figure out a lot of what's happened. And that is the reaction now that people say, oh, I can't believe it, or it's too much, or it's too heavy. What are we going to do about it? It's hard to get people's minds cohesive, because by the time they accept the reality that these conspiracies exist, he says they can't, they're overwhelmed by the magnitude. So he talks about, for total control of the public, how do you do this? How do you get control of 210 million people in America, where you have a democratic process in the United States, and people don't want to believe that this is happening, where the Constitution is sacrosanct? People are raised with the Constitution, and they're not going to move it very quickly. The people have to be groomed and convinced and be ready for another Constitution. Otherwise, it's like saying your mother's a traitor. How do you get people to go in for change? How are they going to accept the fact that he says that 63% of the population is going to be killed, 63%, and you're going to see a bloodbath like you've never seen. You're going to see diseases, and you can watch for these flu epidemic kind of things. You're going to see riots, bombings, concentration camps. How do you prepare people for what's going to come down? Now, I'm going to go into detail next week on the Camelot plan, on some of the things this man's talked about that are in the drawing board, that are in the planning stage. He's the gentleman who talked about planting electrodes in the brain implantations that are very much top priority in this state. That the governor, the attorney general, the mental health department are very anxious to do, to plant electrodes in the brain and control people electronically. We've done a few radio shows on it. I did them before I ever knew this man existed, and he supports my thesis on that. But one of the big problems, one of the big obstacles where you say, gosh, or wow, how can it be, can be exemplified very easily in a new article that came out in Esquire magazine this last month. It's a picture of John Kennedy on the cover. It's a November Esquire. And it's an article about the Watergate research. And I want to show how they put down the serious theories about conspiracy and try to confuse people. This is the kind of confusion they want, where you have so many different theories that you can't accept the really heavy or the important ones. I just have a few minutes left, but the article is about, did there come a point in time when there were 43 different theories of how the Watergate happened? And it's written by Edward J. Epstein, who helped defend the Warren Commission and the Warren Report, and John Barrett from New York City. And they come out with 43 theories, tongue-in-cheek, to make fun of the Watergate researchers. And what they do is they have a few theories that are important, that matter, that could be proven, but they scatter them as if they're not related to each other, so that all the researchers look like they're hanging out on separate limbs of an apple tree, and the apples are going to fall on the ground separately, instead of the fact that they're all coming together and creating one piece of fruit, like one apple, that you can digest and assimilate. They want to make it look like there's just a bunch of people out on different limbs that are not relating to each other. So they take these different theories, what he calls the Liddy theory, or the Dean theory, or the Mitchell theory. He gives them funny names, like the Daredevil theory, which is on Liddy, or the John Dean production, or the John Mitchell, or Nixon's the one. Martha Mitchell says Nixon is responsible. What are they after theory, the act of God theory, Billy Graham, the Mr. X theory, the Haldeman theory, and they mush them all together. Then they take certain items that are could be in fact true, like the ITT theory or the Howard Hughes theory, or they refer to the Arthur Bremer theory, or the 7 days in May, or the tip of the iceberg, and these are all identical. They overlap. They talk about the tip of the iceberg theory, that Watergate is the tip of the iceberg, or the American Reich theory. Well, the tip of the iceberg and the American Reich are identical. Or they talk about my Murderville theory, and in the book that I'm going to do, Murderville USA, is based upon all the murders that have to take place in order to have a police state. But Murderville isn't separate from the American Reich theory or the Arthur Bremer shooting. Killing Wallace is just a part of the Murderville. But Murderville isn't separate from the American Reich theory or the Arthur Bremer shooting. Killing Wallace is just a part of the Murderville. So what they do is they take a lot of serious research, because they, out of the 43 theories, 15 of them all go together, like Richard Nixon, Howard Hughes, ITT, Arthur Brammer, the Midway crash, the American Reich, the tip of the iceberg, and the Murderville, and the executive theory that Ellsberg talks about as part of a large executive coup are all one. But they don't want to admit that that many minds in this country are getting their thing together and figuring out what's happening. So they have to splinter these minds with the ridiculous and make it look like a laughing matter. And that's why in the Realist article I said only the alternate press, the alternative press, is honestly reporting what's happening, because people like Esquire, tongue-in-cheek, have to blow the seriousness of a situation by making it appear comic. Well, our time is out. We'll see you next week, and we'll talk about Camelot, how Politica and Camelot applied to the past 10 years of American history.